Allow me to begin by thanking Professors Cheng and Friel for the wonderful opportunity to be here and begin with an apology. It's a shame to come to your wonderful institution here and give my presentation in English. The only thing more shameful is my French, so I won't bother you with that. Now, this presentation will draw from various parts of the Li Ji in an attempt to construct an early Confucian theory of ritual. This theory, in short, depicts a tragic consciousness experienced in ritual performance, where ritual agents cope with vulnerability, ambiguity, and rupture with the past. My purpose in this presentation is to demonstrate that ritual often involves the coordinated reenactment of conflicting moral desires, such that ritual is in part a performance of ambivalence. Ritual performers reaffirm their desire to model the past, but recognize the demands of the present. They also mobilize the resources of vulnerability to care for others and to turn ritual performance into an embodied confession of their hopes and limitations in confronting a threatening world. The latter half of this presentation will situate this tragic theory of ritual in the broader discourses of ritual studies. Part one, the opening scene of the Liyun chapter. In that chapter, Confucius, after witnessing a ceremony performed in his home state, lets out a sigh. His disciple, Ziyo, hearing him sigh, asks what went wrong. Confucius responds with a lengthy description of two ideal time periods in early human history, both of which he explains were preceded by a pre-civilized era where human beings lived in caves and ate the raw flesh of animals. Confucius laments that he hoped that the world might again attain to the greatness of these two ideal periods. Yet, as evident from the poor performance of the ritual just witnessed, such a desire will not be realized. This opening scene, in general terms, provides a narrative for a tragic reading of early Confucian ritual. Confucius explains that in the earliest period of human history, humanity lived in uncivilized conditions. In this period, human beings did not know how to construct homes, cook food, or make clothing. And as such, human beings lived in caves, ate the raw flesh of animals, and wore the feathers of birds. Fortunately, sages appeared on the scene and taught people to build simple homes, to use fire in preparing food, and to spin hemp and silk. The sages also organized simple human relationships, such as parent in relation to child. This act of civilization, the Liyun explains, marked the beginning of the ritual tradition. Society, meaning interpersonal relationships, material implements and structures, and institutions such as government, is built by the means of ritual practices. The Liyun also goes on to report that as society became more complex, so did the ritual practices that supported it. Sometime after this period of savage conditions, the Liyun contends, a fundamental shift occurred in the development of human civilization. While human beings originally lived in caves and drank the blood of animals, they came to live as one unit, treating everyone as family, living in simple homes, and cooking their food. In this era, which Confucius calls Grand Unity or Da Tong, human civilization lived in accordance with the Great Way, the Da Dao. In the era of Grand Unity, humanity thrived in simple conditions. Later, however, in the era Confucius calls Modest Prosperity or Xiao Kang, human beings concerned themselves with more distinctions, such as distinctions between one's parents and the parents of other people, as well as the distinctions between the people of one's hometown and the people from other towns. The world, due to these distinctions, was no longer seen as one family, but the virtuous leaders of the time cultivated these distinctions in the form of a ritual tradition so that society continued in accordance with the Great Way. In conjunction with these social distinctions, the Liyun explains, people in society were able to create more complex physical structures, such as moats and city walls, as well as more complex institutions that fostered the distinction between rulers and ministers, among others. In this age, human civilization thrived, and attained a level of sophistication and prosperity that could not be attained to in the previous age. Yet in my reading of these passages, humanity also lost several things in this transition. For one, in the era of grand unity, ritual was simple and unadorned. It provided for basic needs such as food and shelter, and it fostered a minimal number of social relationships. It could not, however, bring about a prosperous world. Creating the conditions of prosperity entailed building on and in some regards deviating from the foundational acts of the sages. Because of this, ritual performers in later times are torn between a desire to maintain a strong connection with an ordered past and a desire to render ritual meaningful in a more complex present. This ambivalence, rooted in an awareness of the necessity of acting ritual and the necessity of varying from earlier tradition, is a key component of the tragic consciousness associated with ritual. Secondly, the formation of a ritual tradition also created ritual agents who saw themselves in more distinctive ways. People in the age of modest prosperity, according to the Liyun, became self-interested and became capable of constructing alternative traditions that could compete with the ritual tradition. The Liyun explains that with the emergence of more social distinctions came an awareness of those within one social group and those beyond one social group. Defense fortifications arose in this early period, and weapons emerged in an attempt to overtake those from other social worlds. What this reveals is the contingent nature of the ritual world. Ritual success, in other words, is vulnerable to incompetent ritual performers, people from other social worlds wielding military or other kinds of power, as well as natural disasters and death. These dysfunctional forces impinge themselves on the ritual world with a kind of brute force. In short, the world ritual is meant to construct is set against the backdrop of a dysfunctional world. Ritual performers project their hope onto the dysfunctional world while recognizing that their hope will sometimes be in vain. The Liyun presents us with a view where ritual minimizes dysfunction and projects a hope of order onto this dysfunctional world. Yet ritual does not prevent all dysfunction. The work of ritual is to build an ordered world, and ritual performers enact ritual over and over again to construct this world, but they never fully eliminate the threat of failure. Ritual performance understood as world construction is therefore taken in a tensive sense. Said another way, the ritual world never fully becomes the only world that human beings experience. Rather, dysfunction continues to linger on the edges of society. Indeed, it seems that one of the messages that the Liyun teaches its readers is that we human beings inhabit a world occasioned by both order and anomie. Part two, the mourning rites. The Liji contains many discussions of mourning rites. These rites, covered in nearly two-thirds of the chapters in the Liji, also highlight the tragic consciousness associated with ritual performance. Some of these rites include the calling back ceremony, where shortly after someone has died, a mourner climbs up to the roof to call the deceased spirit back to the body, as well as the practice of putting objects into the tomb of the deceased that do not quite work. Zithers, for instance, are placed in the grave, but their strings are not properly tuned. And this, the Liji tells its readers, is because the dead are no longer alive. Yet, in its view, neither are they fully gone. The portion of the rites I would like to focus on begins after the calling back ceremony and before the burial. In this section of the rites, we might call the funeral procession, mourners follow the carriage carrying the body of the deceased to the grave. The Liji explains that mourners should do this as if the deceased were still alive. The Wunsang chapter explains that mourners should follow the funeral procession to the grave as if they were trying to catch up to the person while still alive. And after not finding him, they are to return to his home, calling for him, hoping to find him there. When failing to find him at home, mourners exhaust their sorrow by wailing and shedding tears. The sorrow of losing a loved one reaches a heightened pitch as mourners fully confront the absence of the person. They are despondent to the point that they, quote, lose their focus and there is nothing but sorrow. What is interesting here is that the Liji does not make the argument that these rites are effective in bringing the dead back to life. Rather, the mourner should not fully expect the rite to alter the course of death. In the mourning rites, mourners come to recognize the vulnerability of their hoped-for world to forces beyond their control. Indeed, what we see in the mourning rites are a series of practices meant to confront this vulnerability. Mourners project their hope onto the dysfunctional world, knowing that it might not change things. They perform the rites to demonstrate their awareness of the fragility of their social world. The mourning rites, as such, become a means of navigating the tension between the desired world and the dysfunctional world. They become a kind of performative therapy for dealing with dissonance. Following this view, ritual is done to display one's understanding that one's best efforts are often frustrated by the dysfunctional world, that people do in fact die, but if it were up to us, they would remain. The mourning rites are particularly apt for demonstrating this point. The death of others presents a kind of ambivalence for many human beings. Our desire to accept the finality of death conflicts with our hope for continuing a meaningful relationship with the deceased. Mourning rites, as such, become an important means of coping with ambivalence. They allow us to live in a world of hope and fear. The intrusion of the dysfunctional world into the social world becomes an occasion for the creation and performance of ritual. Yet ritual does not dissolve the tension between these worlds. Instead, it provides a way of navigating that tension. Part of what makes the world created by ritual meaningful is the possibility of intrusion. The dysfunctional world is dangerous, it kills indiscriminately and is savage. The vulnerability of the ritual world to dysfunction means that everyone living in the world of ritual lives with risk. Yet this risk itself partially renders life in the ritual world worthwhile. If relationships lasted forever, there are fewer reasons to cultivate relationships now. If ritual completely ordered the dysfunctional world, there are few reasons to transcend parochialism and the narrow confines of traditionalism. The threat of loss can lead to morbidity and depression, but it can also inspire the virtuous treatment of others. The possibility of impingement can lead to retrenchment and fundamentalism, but it can also prompt a healthy reappraisal of tradition. The uncertainty of the ritual world in this sense mobilizes the energies necessary for the appropriate treatment of others and for a reflective engagement with tradition. To draw a few larger conclusions, what we see in these parts of the Liji is that the kind of justification that ritual provides for its performance need not be about the eventual triumph of the ritual world. Rather, it can sometimes justify itself by providing a kind of honesty about the world. It reframes the world such that we learn to accept that there are things we do not know and powers that we cannot control. Ritual as such can be seen as an embodied confession of our own limitations. It's a way of enacting our vulnerability and coming to terms with uncertainty. Said more generally, the ritual world as a vulnerable world is a kind of evanescent domain where fragility serves as a motivating factor in the ongoing construction of society, and as grounds for the seriousness with which human beings might live their lives and reflect on themselves as well as their relationships with others. In the next portion of this presentation, I'll briefly situate this tragic theory of ritual with two alternative theories that some contemporary scholars of religion use to conceptualize ritual. The first theory I cast in terms of correspondence. Ritual in this view is meant to shape reality to correspond with a pre-existing ideal. Oftentimes, this ideal is represented in a complex system of symbols, as argued by Clifford Geertz, for instance, or in myths of an eternal return to conditions of paradise, as argued by Mircea Eliade. Ritual as such is meant to construct an as-is world. In other words, ritual acts on the world to change the world into a new and better place. Paraphrasing Eliade, as was done by the gods, so is done by human beings in the performance of ritual. And as is done in ritual, so will be done in the world. Interestingly, after mentioning this, which he takes from a Vedic text, Eliade then notes, quote, "This Indian adage summarizes all the theory underlying rituals in all countries," close quote. While more recent scholars have become increasingly sensitive to universal claims about ritual, many continue to advocate various correspondence theories of ritual and couple them with the assertion that ritual performers do not believe that their rituals change. Axel Michaels, a scholar of South Asian religion, for instance, explains, quote, "If people identify themselves in rituals with invariability and timelessness, they resist the uncertainty of the past and future, life and death. In rituals, they become eternal. related to something that has always been there, never changed, and detached from everyday life and profanity. Thus, rituals are staged productions of timelessness, the effort to oppose change, which implies finality and ultimately death, close quote. To briefly compare this theory of ritual with what I've described as a tragic theory of ritual, we see that in line with correspondence theories, this tragic theory does make an as-is claim. Ritual performers hope to order the dysfunctional world. On the other hand, this tragic theory of ritual recognizes that hope is not always reconcilable with experience, and that the ritual world is still a vulnerable world. Ritual, instead of simply attempting to create an as-is world, also creates a kind of as-if space where performers enact a therapy of honesty in confronting a bewildering world. In perhaps more sharp contrast with notions of changelessness, we see that this tragic theory of ritual does not argue that rituals should not change. Rather, early Confucians believed that even an idealized antiquity was insufficient for creating a prosperous present. Ritual performers build on, but also deviate from, the foundational acts of the sages. Ritual change in this view must occur, but is always done ambivalently, with one eye on the past. The second theory of ritual that is worthy of attention comes from scholars such as J.Z. Smith and Adam Seligman. Both Smith and Seligman provide alternative accounts of ritual efficacy. Smith highlights the awareness among ritual performers of the disjuncture between the ritual world and the ordinary world, and Seligman explains how ritual creates a subjunctive reality. In his 1980 article, The Bare Facts of Ritual, Smith explains that, quote, "Ritual represents the creation of a controlled environment where the variables of ordinary life have been displaced, precisely because they are felt to be so overwhelmingly present and powerful. Ritual is a means of performing the way things ought to be, in conscious tension to the way things are, in such a way that this ritualized perfection is recollected in the ordinary, uncontrolled course of things." Close quote. In Smith's view, ritual is not meant to act on ordinary life. Rather, ritual acts in opposition to ordinary life. Ritual agents perform ritual to demonstrate that they know what ought to have been done. The ritual agent, in other words, recognizes that ordinary life will not necessarily be influenced by the performance of ritual. Indeed, one of the reasons, according to Smith, the ritual agent performs ritual is to demonstrate this very fact. The Gnostic element of ritual performance is significant for Smith. In contrast to scholars described previously, Smith posits that ritual performers are aware of the disconnect between a ritual performance and ordinary life. He explains, for instance, that dramatizing the kill of the hunt in Siberian pre-hunting ceremonies is done to show that, quote, "the hunter knows full well what ought to transpire if he were in control. The fact that the ceremony is held is eloquent testimony that the hunter knows full well that it will not transpire, that he is not in control," close quote. In Smith's view, the ritual performer is aware of the tenuous relationship between the ritualized hunt and the ordinary hunt, and is able to explain why he performs the ritual despite the rupture. Ritual, in short, does not manipulate the world. Rather, it, quote, "expresses a realistic assessment of the fact that the world cannot be compelled," close quote. The strength of Smith's account is that it provides a non-correspondence theory of ritual efficacy from an emic perspective. Instead of depicting primitive actors unaware of the constraints of changing the ordinary world, the performers are depicted as rational agents acting out because of the constraints of the ordinary world. In Smith's view, ritual is done to demonstrate an awareness of these constraints and to serve as a focusing lens with which to view the ordinary world. Adam Seligman, Robert Weller, Michael Pewitt, and Bennett Simon, in their book entitled Ritual and Its Consequences, also put forth a similar theory of ritual efficacy. In their view, ritual creates an as-if or could-be world rather than an as-is world, as argued for in correspondence theories of ritual. According to this group of scholars, ritual works to build a subjunctive social world instead of what they call a sincere world, where authentic or real aspects of the self are sought and manifest in ritual. In other words, ritual creates a kind of illusory world where performers live as if they were living in a world of order. as opposed to actually creating a world rooted in some notion of an authentic self or an original tradition. Ritual as such frames the world for ritual performers so that the illusory world becomes a kind of reality, but the reality lasts only as long as performers adhere to the illusion. Similar to Smith, Seligman highlights the awareness that ritual performers have about the disjuncture between the subjunctive world and the real world. The subjunctive world, in the view of ritual performers, is a preferred world. It does not seek to transform the real world. Rather, it functions in opposition to the real world. In line with Seligman and Smith, this Confucian theory of ritual I have described can cast ritual in a subjunctive sense. But unlike Seligman and Smith, the world ritual creates is not understood in terms of an as-if world in opposition to the real world. Instead, the ritual world is contextualized among other competing worlds, each impinging on the other. Said differently, the ritual world is not taken as an illusionary world distinct from the real world. Instead, it is taken as one of many real worlds competing to define the human experience. Indeed, if we cast the ritual world as a kind of as-if space, it's because the business of ritual can be a risky business, where the odds are often in favor of the dysfunctional world. However, dysfunction as such is not understood as a true or genuine condition of the world. While early Confucians saw themselves frequently living in a dysfunctional world, they did not see dysfunction as any more authentic to the human experience than the ritual world. Said somewhat differently, where Smith and Seligman employ the language of illusion rather than fragility in describing the ritual world, they mask the ambivalent nature of ritual performance. Ritual, at least in an early Confucian sense, is about an apprehensive hope. Ritual performers anticipate the transformative power of ritual while realizing that ritual is a trepidatious act. Put most directly, the performance of ritual is often the very performance of ambivalence. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Michael, for sticking to the 20 minutes. It's not a reproach to Gilles, but I have to be absolutely ruthless because otherwise, if we start, getting late, we're finished. I think we can thank our two first speakers for launching the discussion because this Chinese notion of li of ritual or rites is so massive. It appears to be massively present in the whole of Chinese civilization, but our two speakers have from the very start made us aware that this notion of li, you can only approach it in a way negatively, or by sort of very subtle diagnosis. And I listened to Gilles Boileau's presentation as a sort of diagnosis on what li is supposed to mean, especially through the negative markers like fei li ye, this is not li, this is improper, or wu li ye, there's no ritual here, and listening to Michael Ng. You have from the very start emphasized, this vulnerability, fragility, dysfunctioning, the dysfunctioning of ritual. So we are very far here from the, defining, li as a massive norm, you both of you, I think, have done this very finely, showing that li is sort of very moving and very fluctuant, notion.